Thank you, Chair. Thank you to all honorable members. So as you correctly indicated, Chair, the last time we ended with the Act, and as Joanne has indicated the last time, that she would actually go through them concurrently. So we're going to try and start with the long-term and the short-term insurance act, that will largely be wrapping up. And then, Chair, we're proposing that after the insurance amendments, we go to the Pension Funds Act, and Ms. Altamare will help us with that one. Then the third one will be the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act, and Ms. Lorraine Defenter from FSB will handle that one. The fourth one, actually, it's both the SA Reserve Bank Act and the Cooperative Banks Act. Ms. Janine will assist us with that one, and then we'll be left with only two relatively short acts, and that's the Collective Investment Act, which will be handled by Ms. Rieta Stander, and then I'll deal with the Medical Schemes Act. So for now, Chair, we'll try and take the members through the Long and Short-Term Insurance Act. Reshma?
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to honourable members. The last time we had, I must actually just say that I'm continuing from where Ms. Joanne Ferreira had left off at the last workshop, she extends her apologies. Unfortunately, she's travelling today. At the last workshop, we had concluded just before Section 39. So I think today we'll start with Section 39 on page 25 of the existing matrices that you have. So in essence, the purpose of the amendment is to authorize the registrar to impose certain conditions in respect of transfers and amalgamations. It's a blue amendment. Moving on to Section 40. Section 40 relates to approved transactions. It also empowers the registrar to approve certain amalgamations, demutualizations, or transfers instead of the court. Now, similar powers currently exist in the Short-Term Insurance Act. So this amendment also aligns with the powers that are already existing in the Short-Term Insurance Act. Moving on to page 29, this is basically an alignment to the Companies Act. We're replacing the current judicial management processes with business rescue. So that's all yellow. On page 32, section 42 relating to the winding up by the court. In essence, what this amendment seeks to do is to extend the power of the registrar to apply for the winding up of an insurer without first seeking the minister's approval. Ultimately, what we're trying to achieve here is to actually enable the registrar to act swiftly when required to protect the interests of policyholders. And it also seeks to address current concerns raised by the FSAP in terms of the bureaucratic process within which the registrar must actually follow in terms of securing the minister's approval before he actually winds up.
Yeah. Chair, through you, if I can just add to what Reshma has said, because this provision might come out as if we are... as if we are giving the supervisor more powers, and indeed we are, but it's justified. So just to give you a practical sense in terms of the challenge at times we face as Treasury. So when the supervisor picks up that there's an issue with one of the financial institutions, particularly an insurance company, and after going through a particular process and feels that it's necessary to put some measures in place, for example, stopping that institution from carrying on new business, he usually requires approval from the minister to prohibit that institution from carrying on new business. The challenge we end up having to deal with is that because we are so far away from the institution compared to the supervisor. So remember, the supervisor does the on-site visit. They are quite close to the issue compared to the National Treasury.
So at times we end up inevitably and not intentionally sort of delaying the process a bit because we have to probe, we have to ask questions to understand what exactly the situation is. And at times it can delay, unfortunately, the process, because with some of these institutions you really need to move quite quickly, and particularly to try and protect members in the form of stopping the business from carrying on new business. So we feel that it might be a good policy to just let the supervisor make that call, and for the main reason that he or she would be closer to the issue compared to the Minister of Finance or the National Treasury. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Lorna. Then moving on to Section 43, the voluntary winding up. This is basically to align with the Companies Act amendment as well. It's a yellow amendment. This amendment followed by a green amendment, and basically we're introducing a new subsection, and it seeks to align with the Companies Act somewhat, but it also clarifies that voluntary winding up provisions also apply to a financially sound insurer as well. Moving on to Section 45, prohibition of inducements. In essence,
are we operating as we did before? If there's a question with the section, because
yep.
That was very, very quick to go through Section 40 and the significant new powers for the registrar. Okay, no, I was just checking. Well, of course, I have questions on Section 40. Firstly, I'd just like an example of when our regulatory processes were compromised by a delay where Treasury had to verify what the registrar was doing. I mean, the way you explained it to me now, it sounded like a very good balance of powers between the registrar and the Treasury, where the Treasury acts as a check and a balance on the powers of the registrar.
Section 42.
When did we do 40?
40 is an amalgamation.
42, sorry, did we do 40 last time?
We touched upon it. Section 38, yeah.
No, 42, the one you just covered.
Yeah, so that's the winding up.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, I'm not convinced by the changes in 42. I need an example of where regulation has been compromised and an explanation why that what seems like a very obvious check and balance is actually a problem. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Member. Let me try and explain it further. It's a fair question, Honourable Member. Probably not severely compromised, Honourable Member, because I think as Treasury, whenever we receive such applications, we are quick to act upon them. And I think that's where the tricky part comes in, because you either act too quickly, and to a large extent, you sort of rubber stamp what the register is asking for, because that's the balance you must strike. If you are going to spend a lot of time trying to assess what the register has advised you on, then that could delay the decision from the minister. And while you are in that delay period, the company could be taking on new business. So it is quite a delicate balance. But just to give you an example, Honourable Member, without giving the name of the institution. So sometime this year, we received an urgent request from the Register, whereby he discovered some problems within a certain financial institution, insurance company. And he was convinced, because he had gone through a particular process to engage with the institution and establish what the problem is, and to give them also an opportunity to fix some of the problems and challenges, which they had not. So he had to make a call. And to a large extent, it's also a judgment call. So he submitted the application to Treasury, requesting the minister to urgently authorize him to prevent that institution from carrying on new business. So when we received the application, there were areas which we questioned, but as the answers came through, you then realize that it's largely because not all the full details were given to the National Treasury for various reasons, because to a large extent the details can be quite extensive, to the point that you really don't want to burden the minister with such extensive details. But the point being that the questions we asked had answers to them. But because we are so far away from the process, as I indicated, Honorable Member, because we don't do the on-site visits, because we were not sitting with the same institution in some of the meetings between the institution and the supervisor, it creates an awkward situation for the Treasury, because then you need to also make a call based largely on what the supervisor is informing you. And I must say, to a large extent, the information from the supervisor has been accurate. And it's a trust relationship too. So if you delegate certain powers and duties to the supervisor, you delegate them with a sufficient trust that when they come back to you and say, look, I've done this on-site visit, I've picked up some problems here, I think there's a problem here, we need to urgently move on this institution, you sort of need to trust that what is being given to you by the supervisor is accurate. So to a large extent, Honorable Member, we tend to end up rubber stamping what the supervisor said. Yes, we do some analysis, but the analysis hardly provides new information, and largely because we can't go as Treasury to the institution and do an on-site visit. So I take the point that, yes, it sounds as if, you know, it's a nice check and balances on the supervisor, but we feel when it comes to institutions, financial institutions, the supervisor needs to act quite quickly, because literally in a split second money can move around, and therefore we feel that given that the supervisor is closer to the issues, it's probably better to let them make that final call on the institution. I don't know if that helps a bit.
But as we want to further discuss this issue, let's also bear in mind that there is a compliance aspect to international standard that we are looking at here. That's another angle that we also need to look at it. But that doesn't stop us from interrogating the relevancy of such an application to our situation.
No, Chair, we are aware of international practices. I just want to go back to Section 42 and number 2. You know, we're talking here of big companies, like taking for an example Sanlam, you know, big companies, eh? And we are saying the Registrar may. I've got a problem with that. I'm sure Jenny knows that by now. I do have a problem in that. At the end of the day, the minister is an accounting person. She accounts. She is an accounting officer at the end of the day. And here is a big company like Sanlam, like Old Mutual, like whatever that you can think of. The Registrar doesn't even receive a notification. He doesn't even consult with the minister to do that. That's what I'm saying. Even if it's okay if you're saying the written approval of the minister, you remove it, but at least it must show in the act that there was the consultation with the minister. The register can't just on his own. We wake up and we're seeing the headlines that the register has actually closed down that insurer.
Honourable Member, good point. And I think maybe that's what we need to consider, because I think if I hear you correctly, it might be okay not to require the minister to make the final approval, but at least the supervisor must consult with the minister before he makes that final call. And I think that's a good principle which we are also trying to build into the Twin Peaks, that you need constant interaction between the minister and the supervisor. But ultimately, it probably makes good supervisory policy to let the final decision be made by the supervisor, particularly if there might not be fiscal implications. So honourable member, I agree. I think maybe we can craft it in such a way, and this I think will be reflected in the Twin Peaks legislation, that there should maybe be some form of consultation, but the final decision will rest with the supervisor.
Let's get to know what were the concerns of the FSAP on this issue? I'm asking this because I think at the end of the day, as we craft this particular section, we'll also have to give our response to that, to say, in as far as these concerns are raised, this is how they will be cushioned in this section.
Chair, if I may answer that question. I think one of the key findings of the FSAP was that during a crisis, the regulator needs to move swiftly in terms of managing or kind of winding down an insurance company as part of the resolution processes. And, you know, if there's unnecessary obstacles placed before the registrar in terms of getting to the resolution in order for them to actually protect policyholder interests, then that could impede the registrar's ability to actually protect policyholders. And given that the registrar or the regulator is at the coalface of interacting with the regulated entity, they are probably in the best position to actually make that final call. So I think it was in that context, because this section also is similar to Section 12, whereby we're requesting that the registrar actually be empowered to prohibit an insurer from carrying on any further insurance business without the consent of the minister, because it's along the same lines such that we're wanting to empower the registrar to act. And as Alana had highlighted, it makes it difficult from where we're sitting at as Treasury to be able to appropriately advise the minister on these issues, because he's not, and ultimately the buck stops with the minister if he gets that decision wrong, but yet he may not have the full information to actually make that decision. So the FSAP also recommended that the decision-making in respect of closing down an insurer or winding up should probably rest with the regulator, as they probably have more information on the regulated entity than any other party.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm back where I was when we stopped our proceedings last week. There's quite a shift, and obviously we will have public hearings on this, and I would like to hear what the legal profession is saying, that you're moving away from the court now and giving all the powers to the registrar. in a sense, in Section 39 and Section 40. That is the substantial change. Am I correct? I just want to know that, and then I'll ask more questions.
Through you, Chair. As I said, with respect to the Section 40 amendment, in terms of allowing for the registrar to be empowered to approve transactions relating to mergers or demutualization or transfers of assets between insurance companies and the like, similar provisions currently exist in the Short-Term Insurance Act. So what this seeks to do is to align the Long-Term Insurance Act to powers that already exist in the Short-Term Insurance Act.
Okay.
There's a bit of a discrepancy. It's
okay,
fragmented.
I understand that, yeah.
So,
but that is quite a change.
It is a change, but to the extent that ultimately, in many examples that the FSB has experienced in the past,
yeah,
the court ultimately relies on the FSB's
absolutely
opinion.
I agree.
On
yeah,
transferring assets or mergers.
Okay.
So the court wouldn't decide on a case without the FSB's opinion. In any event.
But okay, then I want to take you to the Long-Term Insurance Act, where they say the registrar of long-term insurance will be the registrar appointed in terms of the Financial Services Board Act. Is that the case? They say, yeah, the executive officer and deputy executive officer mentioned in Section 1 of the Financial Services Board Act shall be the registrar of long-term insurance. Is that so? Yes. Now, if I go back to the Financial Services Board Act to get a definition for the registrar, I don't find it. And that's where we stopped last time. Where is that? Is there omission? Because I want to know, this man is becoming now caught upon himself, and I want to know whether he's fit and proper. So maybe you need amendment there to make sure that this man can take the necessary, or woman can take the necessary decision.
Thank you very much, Chair. Yes, we did note the concern that you raised in the last meeting, and we will certainly carefully examine that to make sure that it's appropriately and carefully delineated in the legislation. As we've noted, the concerns about potential lack of clarity. So we will certainly examine that carefully and potentially develop some proposed amendment. Thank you.
Chair, if I...
This section, because I think there's an acknowledgement that there will be a need for the crafting of the section. So that simply says as we interrogate the final product, we'll then have a final view on the matter. You know. So I think let's proceed into the next section.
Thank you, Chair. Moving on to Section 45, it's prohibition of inducements. What we're trying to do with this amendment is to empower the registrar to prescribe what constitutes an amendment. Currently, as the provision stands, it's very wide in terms of what constitutes an inducement. For example, you get various sorts of, if you buy an insurance policy, there are add-ons onto it. So what we're trying to do is to empower the registrar to distinguish between a positive inducement and a negative inducement. So, for example, if you take out an insurance policy and they probably provide you with a GPS, that's a positive inducement and it mitigates the risks that you as a policyholder would potentially face, and that would be acceptable. But negative inducements whereby it discourages you from claiming and the like, would not be seen in that light. And if there are no questions, moving on to Section 49, this relates to the limitation of remuneration.
Chair, I'm no expert on the insurance industry, but I mean, surely, just as an insurance buyer, I mean, negative inducements are very, very common currently. So this is is there any prescription in the existing laws against it? So it's a new provision. It's quite a significant policy change. What is the international situation here? Is this in line with what other countries are doing? Because I would imagine given what I've seen from the insurance business, that actually many of them depend on these kinds of things to differentiate themselves and perhaps even to make their products feasible or economical. I think it's such a large policy change in a very short section. We need a little bit more detail on that. I need more justification, certainly.
I think just to say that the Honourable Member is correct in saying that it is quite a prevalent problem in the insurance sector domestically in terms of negative inducements, and not only related to the insurance sector, but I think also extending to the banking sector as well. So there is a project underway between the FSB and the banking registrar as well to look at inducements in its totality. In essence, this is an enabling provision to ensure that the registrar is actually empowered to kind of intervene against those practices in the interests of protecting consumers. I'm not aware of what the trend or the practices are from an international perspective. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, your presence is acknowledged. Some occupy in this seat at your behest. If you are ready to occupy your appropriate seat, you are more than welcome. All right.
Chair, if I can just chip in on that, following Honourable Member Harris' comment, maybe it might be useful for us to go back and just check on the international trend, and then maybe we can come back to Honourable Member Harris on that, if it's acceptable.
That's on Section 49.
On negative inducement.
Okay, negative inducement.
Sure, thanks, Chair.
Section 45, eh? All right.
Okay.
You can proceed.
All right. Moving on then, Chair, Section 49, this is a green amendment. It relates to the limitation of remuneration to intermediaries. In essence, what we're trying to do here is to enable the Minister to issue regulations relating to what constitutes an intermediary service and what remuneration can be paid for such a service. I think across the insurance sector, there are problems which have emerged relating to commission charges and admin charges and a whole host of charges that have been levied. The FSB currently has a project underway called the Retail Distribution Review, which tries to look at remuneration across all FSB-regulated entities and to align the practices in that regard. There have also been major developments in this area in the UK, where they've undertaken a similar retail distribution review looking at remuneration practices for brokers, or as they call them, intermediaries, in the South African context. Just to also note that this section will not... We propose that the section actually be the effective date of implementation of this section be postponed until the regulations relating to remuneration and the like come into effect by the Minister. Moving on to Section 50 relating to undesirable business practice.
Honourable Harris.
Chair, if we passed the law like in this form, it wouldn't be postponed. There's no provision for postponing it that I can see.
Thank you very much. At the end of the bill, we have put in place let me just find the correct... In clause 259, the last clause of the bill, we have provided in clause 259, subclause 2, that different dates may be set for different provisions of the bill to come into operation. So that is a provision that is not infrequently provided in legislation, so that if there are certain provisions that may require a bit more preparation and additional subordinate legislation to be prepared, that they could be implemented at a slightly later date. Although overall the legislation would be enacted, the provision would just come into operation potentially at a slightly later date, and that would be indicated through the notice in the Gazette when any other provisions that might be brought into effect at a later date would come into operation. So we have provided that option in respect of probably just a small number of provisions potentially that it might be necessary to slightly delay the full implementation. Thank you.
When will that internal process at the FSB be completed?
We expect it to be completed in the second half of this year. So I think in a nutshell, the regulations will probably be finalized towards the end of the year.
Okay, I think that provision is an overarching one that will cater for any, change of implementation date. Okay. Can we proceed then to the next
section? Yes. As I was saying, Section 50 relates to undesirable business practice. We're, in essence, repealing this section because the section currently also exists in the Financial Institutions Protection of Funds Act, and we think that it's a duplication currently in the Insurance Act. Moving on to Section 51, it's an alignment cost-cutting issue in all of the legislation, so it's basically to facilitate the publication of the registrar's actions on the FSB website. Section 53, this is a green amendment. There's a regulatory gap in that this amendment seeks to close the gap whereby we're wanting to clarify that where a policyholder elects to have a funeral policy benefit being paid out as a sum of money, instead of opting for the rendering of a funeral service, that sum of money must be equal to the value of the service provided. So the FSB has experienced in the past some cases whereby somebody takes out a funeral policy to the value of, for example, 10,000 rands, and then the insurer says, you know, when the policyholder wants to actually take the monetary value of the policy, the insurer says, well, I was able to kind of secure a funeral service to the value of 5,000 rands, and therefore I'm going to compensate you only 5,000 rands. And we believe that that isn't the correct thing to do. So if the policy says that the funeral service is 10,000 rands, and if you opt to take the cash benefit, then you should be paid the cash benefit of that policy. So this tightens that up. Moving on to Section 60, it's also a cost.
Can I just read the new text? And please correct me if I'm wrong. It reads, the policyholder is entitled to demand that a policy benefit which is expressed otherwise than as a sum of money must be provided as a sum of money, in which case the sum of money must be equal in value to the policy benefit expressed otherwise than as a sum of money that would have been provided had the policy benefit been provided otherwise than as a sum of money. That's probably the most confusing clause I've ever seen in any legislation ever.
we'll note that concern, and we will certainly take a look at the wording to see if it can be improved. Thank you.
Okay. Section 60, it's also a cross-cutting issue in terms of publication of registrars' actions. Section 62 relates to policyholder protection rules. In essence, the amendment seeks to enable the registrar to make policyholder protection rules without the minister's approval, and it also enables the registrar to act swiftly by improving disclosures in insurance contracts currently. Moving on, Section 63, here we're basically removing an outdated limitation of 50,000 Rand on policy benefits that are excluded from a policyholder's insolvent, from the insolvent estate. So in essence, what we're saying is members' retirement annuities and savings shouldn't be party to insolvency proceedings per se. And this amendment was proposed by the long-term insurance ombud. Moving on to Section 66, offences. Basically, all of the pink amendments following from Section 66 right up to Section 68 relates to the penalties which the registrar is able to issue, and it seeks to align to legislation across the FSB as well. So you would notice that there is an increase in the penalties proportionate to the offence that has been committed. And it also seeks to kind of remove the fragmentation across all of the FSB registrars. So, for example, categories of offences such as unregistered business, the FSB is trying to actually ensure that similar penalties are levied across similar types of offences across all of the legislation. So you'd see that it's a pink amendment. And then the rest are all yellow amendments, and it basically seeks to align to the Companies Act. So I'm not going to run through them all. Also, just a note,
I'm just glancing at the escalation in these fines. They seem quite significant. 100,000 to 10 million, 100,000 to 5 million, 100,000 to 10 million. It's quite a, how do you justify such a massive increase? Why were we so out of step before?
I've just been informed it's 1 million to 10 million.
1 million
to 10
million.
So not 100,000. There's a variety, sure. I'll provide a policy reason, which is something I touched upon last week. But you want to have penalties which serve as a deterrence too, and that is linked also to the issue of the justice system, right? So currently we've got a number of cases which are still going on in our courts, and those cases, on average, they range from a good 3 to 4 years. And we feel we need to empower the supervisor to be able to serve as a quasi-judicial system. Yes, that shouldn't be seen as trying to replace the judicial system, but it's acknowledging that there are challenges in our current judicial system. And because we are dealing with financial issues, honorable member, people have lost their money, they want to be reimbursed. The longer the cases drag, the more in limbo individuals are, and it creates an unfortunate situation. So one way of dealing with that is to say, let's give the supervisor more administrative powers so that if he or she picks up a problem, and you would know in advance if you have done something wrong, what the penalty would be, then hopefully that would start acting as a strong deterrence on individuals who might be considering doing something wrong. Yes, you will still have individuals who are bold and will still carry on the unlawful conduct. But once you are caught,
then at least there should be a significant penalty levied on you. My answer doesn't answer Honourable Member Harris' question, why 1 million to 10 million? And it's a hard question to answer, but I suppose these penalties were set up when a good 5, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, so they haven't caught up with inflation, they haven't caught up with probably a lot of development. So it's trying to catch up and say, you know, what could be, you know, a penalty that will make someone think twice before they commit an unlawful act.
Now, I just wanted to add, Honourable Chair, yeah, and I think the purpose behind increasing the penalties, you know, penalties are supposed to act as a bit of a deterrent as well, and we're seeing across the financial sector very good examples of cases popping up, you know, and I think it's important to actually ensure that there is accountability, that there is a proportionality in terms of you know, if you contemplating doing something, you know, you need to think twice about the consequences of your actions as well. Thanks. Chair, I think that's it for insurance. Bearing in mind that the Short-Term Insurance Act is similar to the provisions that we've discussed in the Long-Term Insurance Act, it's essentially the same. So I'm not going to run through the short-term insurance matrix. It's the same. So I think we can move on to the pension funds matrix. Thanks. Thank you.
Much appreciated, Chair. Chair, sure. So, Ms. Oltamare will take us through the Pension Funds Act amendments, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to the Honourable Members. I'm going to run it chronologically like we've done all the other ones. So, starting with Clause 1A, which is Section 1. The first amendment is actuarial surplus. The only amendment we are doing there is to give more certainty about the consistent approach for evaluator to use. So the registrar can now prescribe the base on which the assets and liabilities must be valued. That just makes valuations more comparable for the registrar. There will be other amendments that's aligned to this definition, which I would highlight when we get there. On the actuary, in the past we used to approve an entity as an actuary, but taking action where a specific actuary has in fact not performed his duties like he should, it made it difficult to take action because they weren't appointed as a person. This just gives clarity that the natural person will be appointed and not a firm or a company or partnership. The advisory committee, that is a think one that's across all legislation, that just removes all references to advisory committee, which will now be done through consultation. Clause 1E, that's alignment to the Companies Act, that is yellow. 1F, we changed the definition of complainant. And the complaint is directly related to a complaint lodged to the pension funds adjudicator. In the 2008 amendments, what we've done, we included a clause whereby a spouse could have access to pension benefits if it was part of the estate of the divorce. But the spouse, if something went wrong through the determination and the fund didn't give effect to it, the spouse had no recourse to go to the pension funds adjudicator. So we just inserted that the spouse or the former spouse can actually have access to the pension funds adjudicator should there be something that's not correct. 1G, the contingent... Section 1, clause 1F.
No, I was just checking, I was just double checking. Are we happy with it? All right, thank you very much. Now we can proceed to the next section.
Moving to the contingency reserve definition, this definition came about with the surplus apportionment legislation, but there was never clarity that all contingency reserve accounts and any other reserve accounts must be provided for in the rules of a fund. So whenever we insisted on that, there was challenge on that, whereby there was no clarity on when a contingency reserve account could be established or not. So we're just providing clarity that the rules of a fund must be clear on exactly what a fund may or may not provide for. The definition on defined contribution category of a fund, the part that caused confusion there is the minimum benefits that must be payable to a fund. And the defined contribution category of a fund is like an accumulation of contributions. And it wasn't clear that this had to be aligned to the minimum benefit provisions that's further on in the Act, so we just aligned the two sections. On disclosure, it's part of the TCF project that the FSB is currently embarking on, as well as member protection, whereby we now want to make it clear exactly what pension funds trustees must disclose to their members to enable the member to take an informed decision and know exactly what's going on in the Pension Funds Act.
Chair, so TCF is treating customers fairly.
Okay, the surplus, employee surplus account, it's similar to the contingency reserve account. We just say it must be clear in the rules that should a member take a set of rules, it must be exactly clear what should be in the rules. One cat. The Financial Services Board definition, that's an overarching definition that's been inserted. 1L, that is just the definition on fund return, and that's just an alignment throughout the Act. There were different phrases used throughout the Act, and we just making it all fund return, that it's comparable everywhere. Investment reserve account, that must also just be clarification, and it also just gives consistency, and it refers back to the fund return matter that I just mentioned. The definition of a member, the concern that we had here was also kind of from adjudications as well as interpretation issues in the Act, whereby the word member previously meant only members and former members of a fund, but a beneficiary and an unclaimed benefit member transferred to another fund was essentially not an original member of the fund. So we changed that to just give clarity that it's not only related to a member or former member, but that beneficiaries and unclaimed members are included in that. The definition of member surplus account, it's just an alignment that it must be inserted in the Act to give clarity. Another contentious one that I think National Treasury would like to add some is the definition of non-member spouse. The concern in implementing the divorce orders, like we referred to it in the past, it insisted that the fund had a court order whereby the division of assets will be done before a fund can actually give effect to that. The problem that we had was traditional marriages and Islamic marriages don't have a court order necessarily, and it made it impossible for those spouses to get access to benefits. I'm not sure if you want to add something to that.
Thank you very much, Chair. Yes, an issue that we've been aware of for quite some time, and particularly since the most recent amendments to the Government Employees Pension Laws Act that we did a couple of years ago, is the need to appropriately provide ensure that all types of relationships are appropriately provided for in terms of the pensions legislation. And it has been quite difficult to appropriately determine in legislation how to provide for particularly the Islamic marriages. There has been legislation already put in place for traditional marriages and also other types of civil relationships. But the issue of appropriately providing for the dissolution of Islamic marriages has been an issue that has been considered for quite some years, and the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development has also looked at that quite extensively. And so we had proposed the amendment to the definition of non-member spouse, in which there would no longer be potentially a reference to court order. But subsequent to the tabling of the bill, we have also further been considering this issue. So we wanted to just alert the committee that, in fact, what we will likely be proposing when we come back to the committee after the public hearings is that potentially rather than amending the definition of spouse and non-member spouse in the Act, we may instead introduce some wording in Section 37D, which particularly addresses the issue of the distribution of pension fund benefits on the dissolution of marriages of all the different types that could appropriately cater for that. But this is definitely an important issue that we're wanting to ensure is addressed in this legislation. But potentially there may be an even more optimal solution to address it than through these amendments to the definition. And we may retain the requirement that there would be a court order obtained so that then the pension funds always have a definite document that they can confidently and appropriately rely upon as guiding them in how the assets should be distributed on the dissolution of the relationship. Because if the pension fund doesn't have a very clear direction, then that can potentially pose difficulties for the fund as to how they should address these issues properly. So we just wanted to alert the committee to that. But this is an important issue we want to ensure that is addressed in this legislation. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for that clarity, Jenny, because I just wanted to say as the Treasury is busy looking at how to apply Section 37, dissolution of the relationship, it would be critical to also look at the, if I remember, because there was the revision on the marriage or whatever relations according to the Marriage Act, where somebody stays with somebody for 6 months and then she claims she was a member then, it would be very critical.
That might be relating to the clean break rule, am I right? That, yes, so if you divorce, you no longer need to wait until your ex-spouse exits the fund for you to get your share, yeah.
Yeah, that was the contentious issue when we discussed this matter last time. So that's why.
But that has been dealt with.
Yeah, so obviously that provision will be clarified as we move to the finality of this particular process. You know. Okay. Wanted to say something? We can move now to the next section.
Thank you, Chair. The next amendment is just an alignment. It's the official website, the way we're going to, FSB will publish documents. Then there's an insertion of a new definition for pension preservation fund. We are just aligning to the Income Tax Act. Subsequent to the previous amendments, there was new definitions added to the Income Tax Act, which we have to insert into the Pension Funds Act. The definition of prescribed, that is an alignment across all acts. Then 1T, I just wanted to highlight as well, and that is protective disclosures. As we will go through the document, there are different whistleblowing obligations on different entities, and to balance the score,
Members, just be warned, the color code seems not to be the same what is on the screen. If maybe you are still following the
no,
color code approach.
That's fine. So we just put protection in for whistleblowers that they can't be prejudiced if they perform their duties on whistleblowing at the registrar. The next definition, Provident Preservation Fund, that is also just been inserted in the Income Tax Act. We're just aligning the Pension Funds Act. Publish, that is a cross-cutting issue. The registrar is a cross-cutting issue, but we noted the reference to the FSB Act. The definition of rules have just been simplified.
Shirley, Chair, I need a better explanation of publish, because you'd want regulations to be prescribed, actually, in the Government Gazette. I'm worried if we establish this definition of publish, we might treat it as a way to get around the perhaps more onerous expense of gazetting. But obviously, I haven't seen how it's used later on. It just raises a red flag for me.
Thank you very much. The definition of prescribed is defined, you know, particularly to refer to the actions of the registrar and the minister. And in all instances where that term is used in the Act, and there are actions taken by the registrar and the minister, those are referred to in terms of prescribed, and it is appropriately used. And published is more used in other instances where other entities that are not they may be publishing information more that has to be drawn to the attention of the public, but it's not in any way related to subordinate legislation. So it's used in a different sense. So we have been careful to ensure that we refer to prescribed appropriately in all instances and ensure that all of the necessary subordinate legislation and other matters are appropriately referred to in the Act. And this is what we have also tried to do across all of the pieces of legislation that are dealt with in the bill generally. We've examined that aspect very carefully, how the terms are utilized, because we've noted that would be a particular concern for the legislature to ensure is appropriately addressed. Thank you.
Okay, now, Eris, I hope you are sufficiently covered. We can proceed.
Thank you, Chair. The definition of rules have just been simplified to align with Section 11 and the Regulation 30 that is currently prescribed by the Minister. This Act is a cross-cutting issue that has been done across legislation. The definition of unclaimed benefit fund, we are actually just fixing an error that was contained in the 2008 legislation where there was a double negative and excluded death benefits to be transferred to unclaimed benefit funds. So we are fixing that error, and then the funds also raised the issue that where a non-member spouse failed to claim their benefits, and they do receive the order from the member, but they can't get the non-member spouse to tell them exactly what to do with the benefits, they are not able to transfer their benefits to another fund. So we're just allowing where that person don't claim the money within 24 months, that the fund can actually transfer it to the unclaimed benefit fund. The definition of unclaimed benefit fund is just inserted in this policy where that term is used in the legislation. So it changed to the definition of valuation expense. Clarity is just given that where a fund is valuation expense, they don't need to appoint a valuator, and they don't need to submit valuation reports. So you don't need to interpret it throughout the legislation provided in the definition. And then the the same as for an actuary. The evaluator is just a natural person that we want to institute any action against the evaluator, that it will be a natural person and not an institution. Then we are going on to section two. In 2A, we are just, there was an error in the previous legislation where it should have referred to registrar, and it was erroneously included as registration. And then the second part of it is just how we are going to publish documents on the official website, but it's subject to the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, and it will not be in the Gazette anymore, but on the official website. But that's a cross-cutting issue. Section 3 is similar. It's a cross-cutting issue, as well as Section 3B, the removal of advisory committees. And that one is quite long. If we get to section 4, this is an issue that National Treasury raised with us as well, where we find that unregistered pension fund business can continue for years before we actually get to know about them. We are inserting a definition to force any entity person who wants to establish a pension fund to notify the registrar of its intention to do that in advance, and they must register the fund within 2 months from commencing business. So that is just giving clarity to exactly what a pension fund and by when it must be registered.
And if I can just add to that, because this is another key provision in the Pension Funds Act, and this relates largely to consumer protection. So ideally, you don't want a financial institution carrying the business of a financial institution without being appropriately licensed. I think it's a key principle in regulation. So all that we are trying to do and say here is that before you take any contributions from members, you must ensure that your fund is registered with the FSB. So it doesn't help to say you have an intention and then you start setting up the fund, assuming that you will get a license. You must first be licensed before you can commence the business of a pension fund.
Maybe just a question. How do we relate this to the outcry that our legislation in a way doesn't help business efficiency, more especially on aspects of registration for people to set up and start doing business? How do we justify the 2 month provision in that context, you know?
Okay, if I can respond, I think what this will do is it will enable you to start doing business within the 2 months. So you give us notification, you can start business, but then within the 2 months you must submit your rules to get the pension fund registered. So it doesn't stop you from doing business.
No, that is very clear to me. I just wanted to check the rationale, because you see, people are arguing that we are introducing legislations that make them difficult to start doing business in our country. So as a result, South Africa ends up not being an optimal business destination. So I just wanted to check, how do we justify the 2 month provision to make sure that it's not viewed as one of those measures that we are introducing, I mean, to impede quick establishment of business in our country, you know? I mean, maybe there might be some practical examples behind, or maybe there might be international experiences behind the 2 months determination, you know?
Thank you, Chair. If I may also just add on to what Alta said, I think the principle is that, you know, when a fund is actually taking policyholder money or members' money as part of their pension contributions, you know, the risk is that anything can actually go wrong in terms of, you know, the money is actually disappearing, and we see it quite frequently with a lot of pension funds and the like. And therefore, it's a question of balancing protecting member interests within a pension fund and ensuring that when employers set up these pension funds and the like, they get their admin in place in terms of applying to register the rules of the fund with the FSB, give the FSB notification that this fund will be set up. So there's no risk of money actually disappearing or employers running away with members' contributions because those funds were not formally registered. And I suppose it's a strong push towards protecting member interests in that regard, because these are people's life savings, you know, in terms of their retirement contributions and the like. And that's why we need to err on the side of caution to ensure. I mean, it's the principle with insurance that before you set up an insurance company, you need a license to operate. I think this, we've allowed for a two-month window of opportunity to ensure that the fund gets its rules in order and the like, and notifies the registrar before they actually take on, continue for a very long period. And there are examples, and I'm sure the FSB can talk to, whereby some funds actually don't, you know, come and register for years, you know, and they're taking member contributions. And, you know, we just feel that that's not the right principle. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. If we look at Clause 5B, that's just an amendment to Section 4.3, which just sets the effective date. This is just aligned to Section 12, which is in amending the rules, just to put a similar clause in whereby the rules will either take effect on the date set in the rules or the date that is registered by the registrar. Section 4.5, what we had before is we had applications from pension funds to register funds, then we raised a query and it would lie open for years and years and we could never close the matter. That meant we had active funds on our system, which the funds applied for registration, but it actually never took off. So this clause just enables us that where a fund has applied for registration, we raised queries and we had nothing back from the funds for 60 days, we can actually cancel that application as if they never submitted it. That means that fund cannot start doing business as if it ever registered. Section 5.2 was just a technical amendment whereby we just aligned old references to previous legislation, which has subsequently been amended to align the wording to that. And then Clause 6C, we just inserted that the registrar can now approve, as previously only had a person, we're just including an investment vehicle. We find that new products emerge that is not specifically catered for in the Act, so it just enables the registrar to consider such products and investment vehicles for pension funds to invest in, and that investments can be held on behalf of pension funds through those entities. Clause 6D, that is just an alignment to the Companies Act. Section 6, we just align the publication in the Gazette to the official website. And then I think this is another clause that with the public hearings, they might make some noise about it. And I want to also refer to, there was an article in the Personal Finance.
Hey, person, sorry. Section 3B, the Pension Funds Advisory Committee, that's now taboo.
Yes.
Why? Were they? I know you say it's to protect the independence of the registrar, but is it really so bad?
Yes, any response from Ms.
Yes. Thanks, Chair. Just to kind of, I think, to add, I think in our opening presentation last week, we had mentioned that this is quite a key issue for the Treasury as well, and it's a cross-cutting issue across all of the acts that we are amending, as you would see, the repealing of the advisory committees. And basically the rationale and the justification for that is, you know, there are numerous advisory committees that currently exist, roughly around 11 committees, which the minister must actually appoint members. So every time a committee, the term of the committee members expires, the minister must then have to go around and looking for new members to fill those positions,
members who have the necessary expertise and the like. And we believe that we need to kind of streamline and rationalize consultation. We think that consultation needs to be, it's an entrenched principle, and Treasury is a strong advocate of proper consultation with on any legislation or regulation that we publish, and we afford key stakeholders an opportunity to engage with that. So we don't think it should be confined to just specific members advising the registrar or the minister on issues. We think it should be broad consultation with affected stakeholders, and hence, you know, this links to the issue of establishing a code of consultation or engagement for the FSB, which ensures that there's consistency across all of the FSB registrars. Should they publish a directive or an exemption and the like, similar processes of consultation are actually followed. And it's not just confined to specific advisory committees. And in the past, I'm not sure about the pension fund advisory committee, but I know for other committees, they've not been functional. They meet possibly once a year or never ever meet. So, you know, we don't see any value add in the current committee structures.
Thank you very much, members and our officials. I think we should take a 15-minute leg stretch break, and let's make sure that we are back because we still have a lot to go through, you know. Thank you very much. Enjoy your tea.
Ja, ja.